This is SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.
This episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who is brought to you by the Amazon Store. Click on the link on our website before you shop at Amazon, and your purchase will help support our show. This is The Secrets of Doctor Who, episode number 5.
I'm a doctor. I've lived for over 2,000 years.
I am Scottish. I can complain about things.
Shush.
Welcome back to another episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who, and today we're going to talk about episode 5 of season 8, or series 8, and it is the Time Heist episode. Joining me today, three of our co-hosts. Jimmy Akin, good morning.
Howdy, how's it going, Father?
I'm good. Excited to talk about this episode. Also joining us, Father Corey.
Good morning. Glad I could be here this week.
Well, we're glad to have you back on the show. You unfortunately couldn't join us last week, but definitely excited to have you on board again. And also joining us from Boston, Dom Bettinelli.
Hi, Father. I'm excited to begin to talk about the episode I like to call Ocean's Doctor 12.
Yes! Oh, that's what I was going to say.
I beat all of you to that joke.
Yes. Very good. I should have known better. But before we dive into this episode, Jimmy, you had some additional thoughts about last week's episode. Yeah. Was it again? Silence?
Listen.
Oh, listen, and, yeah.
And there was a moment that I meant to bring up in last week's episode, and I just forgot to, but there was something very interesting in the sound design of the show that longtime fans would pick up on its meaning, and newer fans might not. Ever since the time of the Fourth Doctor, there has been a kind of alarm mm-hmm. on the TARDIS known as the Cloister Bell. And the Cloister Bell is only rung during periods of extreme jeopardy, either to when the TARDIS is under attack or the characters are in grave danger or something like that. It's used only for extreme emergencies. And in Listen, there's a moment where they're at in the time capsule at the end of the universe, and the Doctor has been disabled, and they've gotten him back into the TARDIS, and the TARDIS itself seems to come under assault, and the TARDIS Cloister Bell starts ringing at that moment, and that's what tells Clara the danger is real. We have to do an emergency move of the TARDIS. And so if you know the sound of the Cloister Bell and what its meaning is, that tells you that this is real danger, wow. at least in the TARDIS's perspective. So kind of the dynamic of that episode is, are there really these potentially dangerous creatures that are super good at hiding or not?
Yeah.
And the TARDIS at least feels it is in extreme danger. And so you could say, well, that's validation for the idea that these creatures are real. Or you could say that's validation for the fact that the TARDIS is an intelligent being that also could be caught up in its own fears about
these
creatures.
Right. And can know fear and can thereby be wrong sometimes about estimating the threat of a certain situation.
Exactly. So since that was something that newer viewers might not be aware of, I thought it'd be an interesting thing to point out just on the level of the sound design, it can have significant meaning there.
I completely missed that. And that's what I love about this season is that they're doing so many references, hidden references to previous episodes. And sometimes you have to be almost a detective to figure them out. There are a whole lot of references in this episode as well. And we'll talk about that. But first, let's re-listen to the trailer for this week's episode before we do the recap. So again, this one was called Time Heist.
This is the Bank of Carol Braxos.
Picture the thing you want most in the universe. And decide how badly you want it.
We're actually going to do it. Rob the bank.
If we don't, we die.
We must locate them.
What is that?
I don't know. Hate not knowing.
Are you hungry, boy?
The bank is now open.
Yep, the bank is now open. And could you recap the treasures hidden in this episode, Jimmy?
Well, I can at least recap the basic plot, which goes like this. At the beginning of the episode, Clara is getting ready for a date, and suddenly the doctor gets a phone call. And then all of a sudden, Clara and the doctor find themselves in a dark room holding icky alien worms. And with them are two other people. One of them is named Sai. He's an augmented human who has computerized memory and computer interface abilities built into his body. We later learn that at one point in his past, he was kind of forced to forget everyone he ever cared about, which will be important later on. The other is a woman named Sabra. And she has the ability to mimic the appearance of others if she touches them. And we later learned that, in fact, she cannot control this ability. So if she touches anybody, she looks like them. And that has made her very alone because, as she says, how could you trust somebody if they look back at you out of your own eyes? Which is a meaningful line in the show. While they're in the darkened room, they begin to hear recordings of their own voices saying they've agreed to be memory wiped, which is what the worms were for, to wipe recent memories. And then a tape starts playing of a hooded figure with a voice that sounds a lot like former Governor Jesse Ventura. He's named the Architect, and he tells them that they are on the planet Karabraxos, and they must break into and rob the unbreakable bank of Karabraxos if they want to live. They then go through a series of adventures as they attempt to do this. In the process of that, they meet a woman named Miss Delphox, who is the head of security. And they also meet a creature called the Teller. It's an alien creature that reads people's memories and then turns their minds into soup, in the doctor's words. Also their brains. And as a result, they're left as permanent vegetables with grossly distorted, collapsed skulls under their skin.
Not only does he turn their brains into soup, but apparently he consumes the soup as well.
Yes. And we're also told the Teller is the last of its species, which could be regarded as a good thing if you like your memories. They also find a box of six tiny devices that the doctor recognizes as matter shredders. And they're basically, the way he leads us to believe, they're basically suicide devices. Mm-hmm. And during the course of their attempts to escape the Teller, both Sabra and Sai use the matter shredders and commit apparent on-screen suicides. Eventually, the doctor and Clara have almost managed to gain access to the main vault, but then they run into an unbreakable electronic lock. At that point, the doctor says, come on, there's got to be something more here. The Architect, who he hates, put us in this position. He had to have planned for this. And at that moment, a solar storm begins that interferes with the bank's security systems and enables them to get into the main vault. Clara wants to know, how would the Architect have known that the solar storm was going to hit at this moment? And the doctor infers he must be in the future, and therefore this isn't just a bank robbery, it's a time heist that uses wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey information from other time periods. Mm-hmm. They then, in the vault, discover cures for both Sai's problem, his missing memories, and Sabra's problem, her inability to touch anyone without looking like them. So it's kind of too bad they're dead. Then they're captured and taken to Mrs. Delphox, who orders them killed, and the armored guards who were supposed to kill them turn out to be Sai and Sabra. So they're not dead after all. It turns out the tiny devices they found were not actually matter shredders, but teleporters that took them to a waiting spaceship where the TARDIS is located. At this point, the characters go into the most secret place in the bank, the private vault, which turns out to contain a woman named Karabraxos. Apparently the bank is named after her. And she looks very much like her security chief, Mrs. Delphox. She explains that Mrs. Delphox and others are clones of her, and when they fail her, she has them incinerated, so she burns them up. And since Mrs. Delphox has failed to keep the doctor and his companions away from her, Mrs. Delphox is now going to be fired. The doctor picks up on how there's some kind of self-hatred going on between Karabraxos and her clones, And then he starts to get a brainwave, apparently connected to his own self-hatred that we've seen in previous episodes. He goes back to Saibra and asks, "What was it you said about your eyes?" And Saibra repeats the line to him, "How could you trust anybody if they look back at you out of your own eyes?" The doctor then connects this to the one thing he knows, pointing to himself, the one thing he knows about the architect, which is that he hates him. And he, although he's not very coherent at this point, he is very animated about this. And then he gives Kara Braxos the TARDIS's phone number, something very few people in the universe have, and tells her to call him when she's old and full of regrets. The solar storm then destroys the bank planet, and Kara Braxos escapes. The teller appears, and the doctor is still in the process of figuring out what all is going on. He needs to remember one of the things that got mind-wiped by one of the worms, and so he submits to the teller, and the teller brings that memory to the surface, at which point he realizes that Kara Braxos did call him. She was the one on the phone at the beginning of the episode. And she had a regret, apparently, about the teller. And she convinced the doctor to take on this case. He then became the architect, recruited Sai and Saibra, and constructed the entire plan of the episode. So he's really the shadowy figure that we saw at the beginning, telling them what they had to do if they wanted to live. The reason, though, was not simply to rob the bank, but to liberate the teller's mate, which they then do. So it turns out there are two tellers, and the race of tellers can be reborn, which is not maybe such a good thing if you like your memories and your brain to be structured properly. They then release the two tellers on an uninhabited but beautiful world, and then the bank heist gang has a dinner of apparently Chinese food on the TARDIS, after which everyone is returned to their own time and planet, though there are hints that Sai and Saibra may be back, because the doctor makes a kind of call me hand signal to them.
Yes.
And in fact, towards the beginning of the episode, he named the group the Team Not Dead. Mm-hmm. And so that suggests that Team Not Dead may be back at some point.
Who knows?
Finally, the doctor drops off Clara for her date. But as soon as he's alone, he starts musing to himself about robbing a whole bank. And he says, "Beat that for a date."
Yeah. Jimmy, I'm so glad that you never touch a memory worm after seeing an episode, because your recaps are excellent.
Well, thank you. This one, like some of the recent ones, has been a little complex, but
very complex. Notes. But that's why I love to do these recaps, because it refreshes our memory, especially for our listeners. We have listeners that will be listening to this in the future. This whole podcast experience is kind of time traveling.
Possibly in the past as well.
wait, our past? Is that possible? I don't know, but it's fascinating. And for them, especially if it's been a while since you've watched the episode, then it really helps to do a recap. Now, of course, my first question, as always, is going to be, how would you rate this episode? And Father Corey, I'm going to start with you, because last week you couldn't make it. Mm-hmm. By the way, just very briefly about last week's episode, what did you think of the episode, Listen?
It was very interesting. They kind of kept that suspense going of, is there actually something there? Is there, you know, are there actually a race of beings that follow us around that are the shadows behind us, mm-hmm. or in the shadows behind us? I thought they did a good job. Of course, they didn't really resolve it, you know, but they did at least keep that suspense going as a possibility. Actually, when I was watching the episode at first, I thought it was going to be the silence, the race of beings, the silence at first. Of course, it didn't end up being that. At least they didn't say that. But I enjoyed the episode. I thought it was a very well done, good, suspenseful episode. And I thought it was probably one of the better ones of the season so far.
Mm-hmm. When you were a kid, were you afraid of monsters under the bed?
My under the bed was so full of stuff, usually not.
so you're not closets. A Time Lord. You're not a Time Lord. So what did you think of this episode? How would you rate it?
This one was, I probably would give this one a 7 out of 10, you know, to go on that mm-hmm. ranking.
Sure.
I enjoyed it. It was, you know, the comment about Ocean's Doctor 12 was so appropriate. I mean, it really, I saw other people online kind of said the same thing of it just fit like an Ocean's 11 type mm-hmm. plot line down to the, everything was in place and all they had to do was go in and kind of follow the breadcrumbs, so to speak. Well, then, of course, there was the fact that the only way that the final lock would open up was by the solar storm knocking out the power grid or whatever it was and causing that atomic lock to finally deactivate, which very much was like Ocean's 11, where the only way they could get the last, as I recall, the only way they could get the last lock open was the power going out, power grid going out.
Okay.
You know, as I recall.
Yeah.
I mean, again,
yeah.
That's off
no,
the top of my head.
You might be
it's
right.
Been a few
it's
years
been a while
since I've seen the movie.
Yeah.
So, but it was an enjoyable movie or enjoyable show mm-hmm. or episode. Probably not the best episode that they've done, but it was still, it really did kind of enjoy it.
Dom, what about you?
I'd give this one another 8. I'm hitting a stride here with my ratings. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it. I love a good caper. I've always enjoyed the classic movies that have capers, the Ocean's 11 sort of stuff, the Italian Job, all that stuff. So I really enjoy a good caper, and I love to figure things out.
You have a little bandwidth squeeze
trying to guess,
there. So
you know what's happening, what's really going on.
Yeah, we kind of missed your last sentence because it was a little hiccup.
Okay. My bandwidth is a little wonky today. I apologize. So I was just saying I like a good caper. I like trying to figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. So one of the points I wanted to kind of mention, I don't know if it's important to the theme, but the name Cara Braxos reminded me of Braavos, which is the banking city in Game of Thrones, which has a Doctor Who connection because Mark Gatiss, who wrote the Robots of Sherwood episode and is friends with Steve Moffat, was also one of the he played the role of one of the bankers of Braavos in Game of Thrones.
Oh, really?
So I'm not sure whether it's an homage or what, but I just thought it was a funny little note.
Interesting. I like this episode quite a bit. At the same time, I felt that kind of towards the ending, it felt rushed, almost as if they were running out of time and they still needed to do all the reveals. And I felt that they could have spent a little bit more time on explaining us what was going on. And the whole concept of the teller having a mate being locked in a vault, it was all a bit convenient and a bit like, so why is that other teller in the vault? It wasn't explained. There were a couple of moments where I thought it was just to, you know, because it served the story, but there wasn't really an explanation for some of the elements. So that's kind of what I didn't like about the episode. I did like the homage, even stylistically, to the other heist movies. That was pretty well done. I also have to applaud the writers and the producers of this episode again for their creativity with a limited budget. And this is British television. It's not American, an expensive ABC production or not even Netflix. So they really have to squeeze out the value from every penny they get. But the way they used that one set that they built, that one corridor basically mm-hmm. in the bank, and then used lighting and used all sorts of, you know, camera angles to make you believe that it's an entire, you know, underground bank, it was done very effectively. It's the kind of stuff that you learn in film school, actually, to be creative with very limited means. And they did a great job with that, so I have to applaud that. But again, I felt it was a little bit shallow in some of the plot elements, and it felt a bit rushed. What about you, Jimmy?
I liked this one a lot. I didn't like it quite as much as last week's episode, Listen. But I think it was a good, solid episode. I'd give it a 7 or maybe an 8. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I liked the way that they used lighting in the corridors, in particular when the Doctor and Clara get separated, because they're deliberately going in opposite directions.
Yep.
And you can easily get lost of where are we now. And they used like purple lighting for where the Doctor was and red lighting for where Clara was. And that really helped the viewer, I thought, keep track of things.
Yes.
Because Doctor Who is kind of famous for having people running through corridors. And I thought this was a nice way to help give a sense of distance to the viewer.
Indeed.
I agree that they didn't spell everything out explicitly at the end. I kind of like that, though. I like the fact that they left a few things for us to figure out the inferences. Earlier in the show, they established that they have some kind of – the bank has some kind of hold on the teller, and they refer – you know, there's a question brought up, why is he working for you? And Mrs. Delphox says everyone has their price.
Yeah.
And so – and they even have the teller kind of semi-bound up in a uniform that looks like a prison uniform with his arms kind of straitjacketed. So you get the sense the teller is not doing this willingly, and then they let you infer – that the teller's mate is the explanation, that that's why the teller has been working for them.
So because she's using basically the mate as a way to force him into serving the bank.
Exactly.
Oh, now I get it.
One thing Dom noted was that the there may be a connection between the name Kara Braxos and Game of Thrones. The thing that struck me about a lot of the names in this episode is that they're Greek influenced.
Yes, yes.
They have that O-S ending, Kara Braxos, and Miss Delphos.
Yes.
And
the neophyte, the neophyte circuit.
I was just going to say a neophyte circuit. Mm-hmm. And so there seems to be a kind of Greek language subtext to the names in this episode.
Yeah, you would expect a Swiss letter. Jokes, but because of the banks, but
oh sure.
You were saying something.
Psi is a Greek letter.
Yes,
in fact,
yes.
One of the names of the characters.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go through some of the elements of this episode, starting with the beginning. It was very limited in terms of time in this episode, but there's this ongoing romance between Clara and Danny Pink. And he seems to slowly, you know, learn how to speak to women. It's not in the right order, the words, but at least he is saying something, you know. He's more successful in arranging a date, which was kind of cute. But of course, and you know this immediately when the doctor is there, there's something what I loved about that shot where you see the TARDIS in her living room, and she has a tiny living room, and it's like typically the TARDIS, and it's all, you know, it's not even nicely positioned. It's like boom in the middle of her room, literally invading her life. And it's like, come on, you got to come with me. He has no respect.
there's some obvious symbolism there.
Yes. And I like it. It's very, you know, it's fitting the way that they visualize his character and the way that he just puts his TARDIS in the middle of the room.
You know, this is something that is kind of, there's a kind of double inversion here from the way things have been done before, because normally characters, when the doctor shows up, the TARDIS will materialize outside their house somewhere on the lawn or in the parking lot or something. Mm-hmm. And then they come to live on the TARDIS. And Clara has not come to live on the TARDIS. So that's one reversal. And then the other is now we have the TARDIS not on the lawn outside, but actually in the house. Mm. And so you have a kind of reversal where instead of Clara coming to live with the doctor has come to live with Clara.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do remember from the earlier seasons that sometimes the TARDIS would appear in the room or in a house, like with Rose. That would happen quite a bit. But why not just park it outside? I don't know.
Yeah, but at least when I have a lot of images. I'm not sure. It does occasionally appear in buildings, but usually not, as far as I can remember, the companion's home.
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of vaguely remember. Was it with Rose or the girl who was the
Martha,
second?
Martha Jones.
Martha Jones. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I vaguely remember the TARDIS in her room as well.
I think there was an episode where they did appear right in her living room. Again, it was the same kind of thing, just kind of crammed in the middle of the living room, very small living room.
Now, there's the enigma of the telephone in the TARDIS and some people knowing that number. We've seen the phone being used a couple of times, not that often. And the doctor reminds us here that Clara got the number from this mysterious lady in the shop. We still don't know who she is or what that has to do with it. I thought that was clearly a way to remind us that there's also an overarching mystery here. You know, who is that woman? And But of course, in this case, it was just the doctor who gave the number, so he set it up himself. Is this a thing that was used in the early episodes as well, Jimmy?
No, the external phone was never really functional. In fact, if I recall correctly, in the Fourth Doctor's time, they had a character open up the outer phone panel and try to use it, and it was just dead. The idea that the Doctor can be reached by phone, no matter where he is in space and time, is something that really started to come in. I guess kind of the seed for it was in the Ninth Doctor's time, Christopher Eccleston, when he modified Rose's smartphone so that it became a superphone and she could call home across space and time. And then at least by the 11th Doctor, Matt Smith's time, you had him actually receiving phone calls in the TARDIS from historical figures like Winston Churchill and so forth. Then towards the end of his reign, they started to use the external phone on the TARDIS as well.
Interesting. There were some references in the beginning of this episode as well, where the Doctor is, I think he's naming some places where he could go. And one of the places that he mentions is Brighton.
Yes. Brighton is a, I understand it's like a beach resort town in England. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
And he named a couple of other much more dramatic outer spacey locations and then said, or Brighton.
But the joke is, this is an inside joke, that whenever he has suggested a trip to Brighton before, and every time they want to go to Brighton, something terrible happens.
Oh, really?
According to the notes here on the BBC website, when he tried to take Leela to the coastal resort, they ended up miles away on Fang Rock facing a Rutan invasion. And later when he attempted to attend the opening of the Brighton Pavilion, he got the time wrong and the place right, but the visit still ended in disaster when K-9 was blown up whilst taking a dip on Brighton Beach. So there are at least two episodes here where Brighton means disaster. And it sounds so mundane. So like, that's the place where nothing happens. But not in the Doctor Who universe. And then they, well, you know, what's going to happen if you touch the phone? My first thought was, how do they get teleported? You think they're teleported, but actually they just, that's the moment where the memory wipe begins.
Well, I think they purposely kind of, at that initial flash over, almost look like a teleport. You know, where they kind of wanted to put that image in your mind and, oh, by the way, no, it really wasn't a teleport and there was more that had happened before this that they just don't remember.
And I think that we could have known that this was a memory wipe because immediately afterwards we see them with these memory worms in their hands. The Doctor's actually using one of those memory worms as if it were a phone. And then, of course, Clara is like,
the nice jump cut.
But these memory worms have been featured in the 2012 Christmas special, The Snowman, where they were also used or introduced as creatures that can wipe away chunks of memory, but the rest of your brain, at least, is not wiped and is fully functional. So it's different from what the teller is doing, where it's just basically one big soup.
Incidentally, note the kind of wordplay that's going on with the teller. Because banks have tellers. Normally they're the people who, you know, count your money out for you and so forth.
Oh, that's great. I missed that.
And here the teller is the one who tells which person is guilty.
It's actually a revealer, someone who can tell what's going on in the deepest, you know, deepest areas of your mind. We also get introduced then to the augmented human and the mutant lady. What I liked and chuckled kind of like the augmented human, he's sitting there as if everyone knows what an augmented human is for, and he is like, well, yeah, sure, I'm a gamer. I'm like, wow, so in the future, people like me are going to have all these implants just for gaming.
I thought that was a nice touch because, you know, there are – obviously not all gamers are this way, but there are some gamers who are kind of obsessive, and one can imagine implants as kind of the ultimate gaming experience.
Well, it's actually something that people are talking about now, you know, with all the developments with virtual reality, with the Google Glass, and, you know, what's going to be the next steps? Google implanting something in your brain, you know, to have immediate access to whatever thoughts you have. Where is this going to stop?
Think of something like the Matrix, where they could basically just jack right in.
Sure, sure. I think that's clearly something they're kind of referencing here.
While we're mentioning Psy and Sabra, something that occurred to me is that, you know, I mentioned in the recap that it looks like they may be back in the future. And I think that they may end up replacing the Paternoster gang. The Paternoster gang is Madame Vastra and Jenny and Strax.
Yeah.
And they were introduced in the 11th Doctor's time. Mm-hmm. And they kind of are oriented towards the, as a team, they're oriented towards the past because they live in the 19th century.
Yes.
And even though they appeared in the first episode of this season, there's often a kind of handoff of the cast from one season to another. So they might not be back, or maybe they will, but Team Not Dead could be taking their place because they play a similar function of being a kind of action team that can have adventures with the Doctor. And they're the opposite of the Paternoster gang. Instead of being oriented towards the past, they're oriented towards the future. And because they have these mutant abilities and augmented abilities. And so it seems like, I mean, if I were writing Doctor Who and I wanted to come up with a kind of replacement for the Paternoster gang to keep the show feeling fresh, they're exactly the kind of thing I would come up with.
And personally, I wouldn't mind the Paternoster gang being replaced, because I was getting a little bit tired. Even in the first episode of this season, I was like, we've already seen that. It kind of like...
and the whole Jenny Madame Vastra thing.
It was getting a bit tiresome. So, but I wouldn't be surprised if they would bring the Paternoster gang back for the occasional, you know, episode where they just dress up in old clothes and stuff and go to the 19th century. That's kind of what they did in Star Trek as well. I kind of like these two new people, and I like that they're very different, and at the same time, there is something that unites them, and that also kind of matches a current trend in the movies, which is that your gifts, these talents that they have, are also curses. And that reminded me immediately of the X-Men franchise. Or Spider-Man. You remember Rogue, who has almost a similar dilemma or problem. Is if she touches people, she sucks out the life. And that's why she is always alone. She cannot embrace, she cannot love, she cannot hold people, she cannot kiss people. So she's... Her talent is actually a curse. And with, what's her name again?
Sabra.
It's almost the same. She cannot truly hold anyone because, well, she's cursed with this gift. And the difference, of course, is that the both of them are cured from this gift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now in Sai's case, though, his cure is gets his memories back, but he still has his abilities. I would suspect that in Sabra's case, she can now touch people, but I'm betting if they bring him back that she'll be able to still shape change at will. Mm-hmm.
But she's now in control of it.
And
exactly. Yeah,
that would be great. And by the way, of course, also creating another analogy to the X-Men, which is what's the blue lady again?
Mystique.
Who can all? And that's of course a very easy. That's just a great person to have around, because you can just use another actor and you have so many story abilities with something that is actually, as long as you don't have to show the transition, which they do with Mystique, and it's probably expensive CGI, but with Sabra, it's slightly, you know, lower budget, but you can use the same plot. She has the same functionality in the stories.
You know, they've actually done something similar to this before with a companion back during the fifth Doctor's time, Peter Davison. Uh-huh. He had a companion very briefly named Chameleon with a K. And Chameleon was a robot that shape changed. And so they had a robot prop, an animatronic, that they would use for Chameleon in his native form. Uh-huh. And then he would be replaced by an actor of whoever he had transformed into. And this was spectacularly unsuccessful.
it sounds very cheesy.
Yeah, because this is 1980s robotics, and so it's extremely clumsy and limited, but John Nathan Turner, the producer, just was in love with this idea. Everyone else hated it. And then the guy who built the chameleon prop and who was the only person who knew how to program it died suddenly. And so it went really badly, and they only used Chameleon for a few episodes. And in the end, the Chameleon Companion was hated by so many people that fans took malicious joy when the Doctor himself put Chameleon out of its misery.
That reminds me of Lost, you know, where they introduced somewhere in the third or the fourth season two new characters and everybody hated them, and so they were killed off two episodes later. Sometimes you have to do that. You make a wrong judgment call. And
well, and that's happened several times with Doctor Who. There have been several companions that they introduced, particularly in the early years, that totally did not work, and they got written out very quickly. There was one companion named Katarina, who was a Greek. The Doctor met her during the Trojan War, and she was so unable to cope with the idea of technology that she interpreted everything in terms of her Greek religion. So she thought the Doctor was a god, and he was transporting her to the celestial temple in the TARDIS, and she thought she was dead, and he was navigating her through the afterlife. And so this spectacularly didn't work for the audience.
I imagine it gets old very quickly.
Yeah, she became the first companion to die. She was airlocked in the Daleks' master plan and saved the Doctor, but ended up being ejected into space.
Right. Wow.
there was another character in the Second Doctor's time named Dodo, who was a young British woman, kind of a mod 60s young woman, and she was regarded as being remarkably simple, you know, not very smart at all. And she also didn't work. And the way they got rid of her was she fell under the mental influence of a computer in a serial called The War Machines, if I remember right. Uh-huh. And after a couple of episodes, after she's been liberated from its mental influence, she just goes to the countryside to rest and never comes back.
She went the way of the dodo.
Yeah.
I love the moment here in the beginning where we first see the bank, and there's this obvious CGI shot taken from above with some of the clients walking around there. And then you get that. And I love that. The music and the slow motion totally is, you know, every modern heist movie does that. And they did it deliberately. I thought it was a brilliant joke, a visual joke. And then the Doctor, you know, talking about a telepathic sniffer dog.
Well, another homage to the heist genre is that whole voiceover as you see them preparing, you know, the steps being taken.
Yeah.
So you have that explanation over the top of it. I mean, it hits that genre on in so many beats throughout this whole episode. Mm-hmm. It really inhabits this. I mean, Stephen Moffat wanted to do a heist episode of the Doctor.
How do you call those little montages? The A-Team was famous for that. Like every episode of the A-Team, you would have a sequence with just music, and then you see them getting ready for whatever plan they were carrying out.
They would be building a helicopter out of an old van.
Yes.
Yeah.
Whoa.
And then, of course, this teller hunts guilt. And that was when I was thinking, yeah, that's interesting. Now we're getting into some depth here with the episode. Perhaps this is all going to be about guilt and memories that are, you know, repressed memories or whatever. They didn't go as far as I hoped they would go. However, the whole theme of, you know, how important memories are to you, that was something definitely in the story arc of Psy, which was very important. So the Clara kind of reacting to his, you know, him telling that he can just wipe out parts of the hard drive of his brain. And she's like, oh, well, that would come in handy. And he's like, yeah, but I had to wipe out memories of my family, of my friends. Then you start to realize, oh, wait a minute, that's actually a curse if you have to do that.
I saw someone online who was, in a way, they were criticizing the way character the way Clara had been developed as a character, because they haven't given us, even though we've seen some of her relatives, none of them are memorable characters that we really know. It's not like Rory was to Amy or the way that Jackie and Mickey were to Rose. And so when we have her imagining what it would be like to lose everyone she loved or memories of everyone she loved, we don't know who those people are really in her case.
Yeah,
I still thought it worked. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a problem with it, but I agreed with the person that it would have been even stronger if she had other characters that we knew the way we knew Jackie and Mickey and Rory that she was imagining forgetting.
Although I am actually kind of glad that for once we have a companion without all the family backstories, because that was a little bit too. I did not always like all those family ties. I mean, I liked Rory, and I love that they kept that in for two seasons. But you know, the what was it? The mother of
Jackie.
Jackie, come on! I'm getting so fed up with these people.
But this is actually new for Doctor Who. Not in old Doctor Who, they didn't have any of that.
No.
He had family for Donna, her dad, her grandfather, and her mom.
Wilf, yeah.
I liked his her grandfather. He was kind of an interesting guy, but the mothers.
Martha Jones, her family was actually a big part of that arc of Martha Jones.
Yeah. So, then we get introduced to, of course, what turns out later to be the clone of the owner of the bank, and then you get that whole conversation where they start to realize that the fact that the architects put them there is because, well, since they're all part of that team, there must have been a reason for them to actually carry this out, even though they don't remember what it was. So there has to be something that they need or that they want. And the doctor then says, what is the thing you most desperately want? And that's probably in this bank. Now for Sai and for, Sabra. it becomes obvious what that is, but then the doctor and Clara are wondering, you know, what would that be for us? Did that question got really answered in this episode?
I felt like it did.
Yeah? Dom?
I was thinking afterward, what is it what motivates the doctor the most? He saved a creature that is the last of its kind. And if anything else we've seen from the doctor is he is the last Time Lord.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that motivation. I mean, there's something going on with the self-hatred. That's part of it. You know, he talks about he hates the architect, and that's how he realizes the architect is him. And so there's this self-hatred, and as well as this compassion. He's battling with this sense of, am I a good person? Like we've seen this throughout this series, is, you know, am I a good person? I hate myself. I have to save this creature that's the last of its kind. And I think there's an element that I think we're coming to a head with this whole guilt that he's carrying over the fate of Gallifrey. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is part of it. And so I think the doctor went through a lot to save the teller and its mate. And what was it that motivated him? I think it has to do with this. He has to save the creature because the creature is sort of a proxy for himself or for Gallifrey.
That's interesting. So it would be linked to his identity / vocation of being a savior, and then his inability to truly be that savior. That was one of the things in this episode that shocked me. Of course, not really knowing what the outcome of the episode would be, but when he handed over the exit strategy, basically a suicide pill, I was like, wow, this is twice that the doctor can't really save these people. And the only solution seems to be, you know, assisted suicide, a.k.a. euthanasia. That's kind of a big defeat.
But, of course, Sabra knew that the doctor was lying about the purpose of these. She could tell he had been lying about it. You know, one of the things I wanted to actually mention in relation to this being a savior aspect is that when they first break into the private vault, there's music, classical music playing. And it's Mozart's overture to the abduction from the Seraglio, which the plot of which is a hero is rescuing his beloved from the Seraglio or harem of an Ottoman Turk pasha. So they are saving the beloved from captivity. And so, I mean, even the music, like Jimmy was talking about the sound design from Listen, you know, even the music that they've got playing here goes into the plot of this series of this episode. And so, you know, again, I think it's playing to that idea. He's saving, he's rescuing this creature. He's bringing them back together again.
Fascinating. That's the kind of stuff that I love, though. I don't know if they constantly do that on purpose, but I love these little hidden references and analogies between these episodes. There is actually I wonder if this was on purpose or just a coincidence, but there's the mission that this group gets, which is they agree to rob the most impregnable bank in history. And that word was also used by the Fourth Doctor in the episode Robot, where the Fourth Doctor doesn't like that word and says, I never cared much for the word impregnable. It sounds a bit too much like unsinkable. And when his old friend asked what was wrong with unsinkable, he replied, nothing, as the iceberg said to the Titanic. Uh-huh. That's a classic line.
One thing that I thought you could criticize this episode about, although it's a minor thing that at least for me, it wasn't a huge distraction, is the most impregnable, unbreakable bank in the universe apparently doesn't have security cameras and microphones in all of its rooms, because they're openly talking about their plan and doing stuff that should be picked up by an ordinary 21st century security system. Mm-hmm. But if they were really realistic about that, we wouldn't have a show. So I was happy to waive that for purposes.
Well, it was almost as if they were so reliant on their, you know, super duper genetic identification system and the fact that they could recognize the breath of people, that, you know, perhaps because of all that sophistication, they forgot about very simple means to, you know, control the space, and that's just by putting a camera in place. That's kind of like over reliance on technical solutions, and you forget the obvious.
Yeah. Well, the old pride goes before the fall as well. They figured we're impregnable, so we don't need to worry about things that.
Well, hence the Titanic analogy, perhaps. Unsinkable.
Another minor criticism you could make is we're shown in the beginning during the architect's narration that people who are unauthorized are incinerated on the spot, and they actually show us that.
Yeah, yeah.
But then we don't – that's not what happens to the intruders in the bank. They use the teller on them, and they keep them around and put them on public display. You know, he's ready for his close-up. And so they don't actually – that doesn't seem to jibe with what we were shown in the architect's opening video and narration.
Well, the opening video almost looked like an advertisement for the bank.
It did.
Something you would pick up on television, and it's like, we are so secure, and we will incinerate every. And it's almost as if the ad tries to hide the much more gruesome reality of what happens to if you break into the bank. It's almost as if they don't want to show their their biggest tricks to keep people out and keep people from ever breaking the bank again.
That's a good explanation. That video does look like an ad with that K logo wipe zooming in to change the image every so often.
And it kind of makes sense for a bank not to tell everything
and
how they do this. And apparently this is not the first time that people get in, because isn't it the lady with the Greek name who says that it happened in the past as well, and that her previous clones disappointed her, and that's why she makes new clones every time?
Oh, yeah, Karabraxis does say that. Also, Mrs. Delphox shows us several intruders who have been souped by the teller.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Not souped up, but souped out.
Yeah.
I like the dimensional shift bomb. It reminded me of the game Portal.
Yeah.
So when the bomb's usefulness is over, it goes back to being a floor again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was where we kind of got to see the childness of the Doctor again, you know, that childlike attitude that he sometimes shows, where it was almost like a kid with a new toy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, this is so great. Just kind of, you know, it beams it to another dimension.
Yeah.
That's how we put it.
No, it is pretty great.
With a big cheesy grin on his face as he's saying it, you know?
But he's always glad when he figures something out. And he is also the one who realizes that guilt is their true problem. It's not the fact that they can't get into the vault, because that's all been arranged by the architect. But it's the fact that they are guilty, and so they are a target for the teller. Hence the memory wipe. So at that stage, we start to understand why their memories were wiped. And I kind of like that they kind of don't keep us hanging for the entire episode.
Or do we? Because if they had retained their memories, then they would know they're there to help the teller. And as soon as the teller started reading their minds, he would realize they're there to help him.
But there was that connection between the teller and
she would have. Yeah, she would have known as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they explained that. And presumably she told that to him when they were talking on the phone.
Yeah.
You know, there's a literary allusion with this whole episode that we haven't mentioned at all yet, which is the resemblance between the teller and the minotaur of Greek myth.
I was thinking the
shape of its eye stalks are like horns. And the minotaur lived in a labyrinth beneath a palace of the wealthiest king.
That needed to be penetrated to get a bride.
Exactly, yes. Oh. And of course, and then Daedalus and Icarus... where Daedalus was the architect of the labyrinth. I mean, there's all of these literary allusions, and I haven't drawn it all out myself. I actually just was thinking of this while we're talking here. But all these literary allusions that might give us some clues as to, you know, what it is the writers are trying to tell us about the Doctor here in this episode.
Well, and it definitely explains the Greek allusions. It's kind of like matches the Greek mythology that is kind of hidden in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I'm getting more and more appreciative of this episode the more we talk about it. That is some clever writing, and I'm not sure everyone noticed it. I didn't. I kind of love that line from the Doctor. You know, why worry? There's no immediate threat. And then immediately an alarm start blaring, and I should stop saying things like that.
Something that I thought was interesting, you know, they've played a lot recently about what's the Doctor's real name, and I don't think Stephen Moffat is going to give us that during his reign, certainly.
I hope not. I hope they'll never give us.
But, so they've pointed out repeatedly recently that the Doctor is just a kind of assumed name that the Doctor took on. And in this episode, he takes on another name, the Architect.
Yeah.
And in the next episode, he's the Caretaker, which is even the title of the episode. And so he seems to have some shakeup with his kind of cover name going on a kind of metatextual level.
Yeah.
And that could be ramping us up for his becoming, or somehow part of him becoming, the Valeyard. I'm interested to see, do they keep that theme going of the Doctor taking on other parallel the names?
Almost as if all those qualifications of this Doctor, aspects of his mission or his identity.
Mm-hmm. And it could signal some uncertainty about his identity.
Hmm. The Architect reminded me of the Matrix. Was it the second Matrix where we're introduced to the Architect? The basically the Wizard of Oz behind the scenes, and everything that happened before, and you're much more part of an overall plan than you think you are free, and that you are making the decisions, but it's all kind of scripted. I thought they were making a reference to that, but yeah, it might actually be more than that. It's the planner. It's the guy who has everything under control. But does the Doctor truly have everything under control? Let's see, what else have we got here? There was the Psy. When they enter the prison area of the bank, and Psy is visibly shocked by this guy missing his brain, basically. And he tells the Doctor, you know, don't let me end up that way.
And so, you know, he's got to suicide before the end of the episode.
I almost felt, at first I was like, wow, this like a euthanasia kind of metaphor here. You know, don't let me end up that way. Kill me before that happens. It's something that you hear a lot in these discussions about euthanasia, and you know, people are afraid of being robbed of their memories and living. When people think about them. What's the word in English when you lose your
senility?
Senility. And a lot of people today are very much afraid of that, and they think that that is not truly, you know, a human dignified life anymore. And a lot of in my country here in the Netherlands, of course, we have a very liberal euthanasia situation, and I know that a lot of elderly people are very afraid of losing their memories, losing their sense of identity, and that's why they sign this, you know, euthanasia declaration. Before, when that happens, kill me.
Yeah.
Which of course is horrible, because that's something you say when you're not in that situation.
Right.
And so these doctors that actually act upon these declarations. It's still something of the past, and the person that is right there in front of you is in a different situation, which you cannot truly predict how you would feel at the time. So that's what made me kind of like, I was like, ooh, that gets very real, this whole conversation. Mm-hmm. But then I was thinking, of course, the reason that Sai is so sensitive, and when he sees that guy, he actually sees himself. Because he doesn't remember his loved ones, so he knows how much suffering that has caused, and hence perhaps his dread of being in that situation where he won't remember anything anymore and anyone anymore. But still, it was, you know, this whole episode. It's multiple times I was reminded of the whole euthanasia debate, and I'm not sure what the debate is currently is in the UK and what the situation is there. But I know that in several countries in Europe, you know, these frontiers are moving and shifting, and it's constantly based on this idea that, you know, what is human life? What is worth? What is a life worth living? It should be a sentient life, a life where you are yourself, where you are in control of your mind, where you can think logically, where you can remember who you are. And I was kind of thinking, what does this episode say about that? And ultimately, in a way, it is. I think this episode is telling us that even if you have half your memory wiped out, it doesn't mean that there is no sense to your life, that there's no meaning. The meaning might be in your past, but it's still something that is relevant for today. You just have to find it again or something like that. I don't know.
And Clara is kind of a voice of all that. I mean, she, once she realizes what the matter shredders are supposed to be, she's totally opposed to their use.
Yes, yes.
And she's kind of served as the moral voice, not just in this episode, but also with Into the Dalek and so forth, where she was standing up to the doctor and not letting him take the morally easy way out.
Yeah.
Also, there's kind of a theme. I was thinking about this. The society we see on the planet Karabraxas, or the planet where the bank is anyway, it's another one of these kind of standards in Doctor Who, where you have this glittering futuristic utopia that is at the same time completely inhuman. In one
cold.
Way or another. And that's something we seem to see a lot in Doctor Who, these outwardly very prosperous, very technologically advanced civilizations. But then it turns out, oh, yeah, and this is only possible because we're torturing a monster in a basement somewhere. Yeah. Or everyone who disagrees is instantly killed. But have a pleasant day, everyone.
it's kind of it's a bit of a trope in science fiction. When they think about the future, it's often a society that seems ideal. This is an ongoing theme, or a recurring theme in a lot of Star Trek episodes as well, where these ideal societies always have a secret. There's always someone or a group of people that pay the price for that, you know, seemingly too good to be true society.
Yeah. And it's kind of and that's true, because we're always going to have original sin with us. And there's a danger of if you're making everything look really great on one level, what are you doing to make that possible on other levels?
Yeah. Yeah. And nothing is what it seems. in a way that the good guys, those people that look like the good guys, like this lady that's running the bank, she seems to be very much in control. But is she truly, you know, and is she impervious? Is she impregnable to regret? Is everything just cold, technological, self-interest? And the end of this episode seems to, you know, suggest that even those very cold-hearted people have the opportunity to repent and to realize at the end of their lives that you know, there are things that they want to set right and change. And fortunately for this lady, she can still, you know, call the doctor to make things right. But I thought that was very interesting, because that's also a theme very important in faith, where, you know, at one point in your life, there might be a moment where you regret things you've done in the past. And who you're going to call? Not the doctor. For Catholics, would call a priest. You would go to confession. And that's also a way to kind of at least show your intentions, that and show that you are repenting and that you do realize that what you did was wrong. And
that's kind of what Miss Delphox or Kara Braxos does in this episode when she calls the doctor, because she has to admit to him, I you know, subverted this species and its ends and put it and captured one member to force another to do horrible things to someone else. And here is how you can fix that. She had to give him details of the security of the bank and the solar storm and everything so that he'd be able to do it. And so she had to both confess and lay out the restitution path.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the doctor is saving the tellers, their race, their future, because they become, of course, the new Adam and Eve for whatever planet they're dumped.
Far away from the minds of others.
Very quiet planet. No more, you know, brain chatter. Almost like a world without the internet, I was thinking, or without Facebook or Twitter. But he also saves Sai, and I will remember Sabra. Her name at one point, Sabra. Like I've touched one of those memory worms. And that's what Sabra actually tells him right before she uses the escape, the exit plan. And it's finally a good man. And, you know, it took me a while to find one. It's almost hinting at that there have been things in her past that we don't know about, but that she, too, has been a victim of whatever, you know, the world did to her. Sai is at one point a bit angry with Clara, and, you know, you're just like him. You're good at excuses. So I'm not sure if that has any, you know, long-term bearing on what he's trying to tell us, the viewers, with that.
It could. At some point, Clara might realize that she has been making excuses for the doctor. That could be setting us up for something further down the road.
I'm thinking that she's constantly coming up with these excuses because she realizes that the doctor needs her help just as much as, you know, the other way around.
More,
in a way, and that's what there was this throwaway line at the end, you know, where the doctor calls her boss.
Yeah,
I'm thinking, you know, also, that's kind of what it feels like, this relationship. She's in charge, and she's actually redeeming the doctor, or in the process of redeeming him.
There was also the line in Into the Dalek where they resist calling her his companion, and instead she says she's his carer, which I assume is British for caretaker. And so that would be another illustration of the same theme of she's helping him more than he's helping her.
Yeah. By the way, speaking of Into the Dalek, the innards of the Dalek are exactly the same factory that they used for the part of the bank where they go when they use the bomb, and it's filmed on the same location. So they used it both for the inside of a Dalek as well as for the inside of this bank. And it, of course, is all, you know, a very simple, effective way to cut corners and cut costs. And I wouldn't be surprised if they just filmed all this in the same week.
Oh, very easily. They have production blocks where they'll go to a set of locations, I guess, where they know they're going to be using them for several episodes, and they'll film everything that they're going to need in that area in a season.
How difficult should that be? I mean, of course, these are professional actors, but I just can't imagine just shooting all these complicated stories out of order and not chronologically, and then you just have to trust that somehow the editors know what they're doing. It's fascinating. I'd love to see the extras or the behind the scenes of the entire season and see how they planned this whole, you know, the whole season. Because they've been even filming last year. They were already filming for the opening episode of this year and stuff like that. That is so fascinating. It's kind of not really pertinent to this discussion, but it's something that I'm very admirative of for Doctor
admiring
Who.
Admiring of.
It's with these simple means, they've been so effective in storytelling.
One of the things that I find interesting is England, I guess, or Great Britain is such a small place that at least, I'm sorry, by American standards, it's such a small place that there aren't that many locations they can film all these things without attracting public attention. Mm-hmm. And so if you go online, you'll find YouTube videos of that fans have shot on their cell phones as they're filming an episode.
Yeah.
And so you'll see, you know, a brief moment that might get used in an upcoming Doctor Who episode, and you may hear a little bit of distant dialogue or something like that, a single line or two. But I'm not aware of any parallel to that in like American science fiction fandom. You don't find similar, at least I've never seen similar clips of them filming an episode of an American science fiction show. I guess maybe we have greater set security, or we've got a lot more remote places to go film.
Well, every once in a while you will see some clips from, you know, a film shooting in New York or in LA.
Right.
But that's not usually for science fiction. I guess if you would live in Canada, where a lot of the science fiction television series are produced, you might have
more of that.
A bigger chance. And of course, someone who is experiencing the problems of filming in a small country like the UK is our good friend J.J. Abrams, currently trying to film the next Star Wars movie in secret. Mm-hmm. And Dom, you and I have been talking about their latest mishap on The Secrets of Star Wars, which is another show that we produce. And can you briefly tell us what was going on there?
Well, they were filming at a former airbase that's now a public park. And some fellows over there with a drone managed to send it up high and take some aerial shots of the set and some of the set pieces, including some very famous spacecraft.
Certain ships.
and someone else with a long lens and shot a video where we heard the director actually yelling out directions to one of the actors that we know is in the movie, using his name, in fact. So, it's exactly what you're talking about. People are managing to get into these places and to get close enough where they can actually see what, you know, this top secret set and what's going on there.
And that is why they will never film Star Wars in the Netherlands, to my chagrin, because that's an even smaller country.
Well, I wonder here in the United States, the studios have developed enough studio cities, if you will, where they have their own outdoor sets. You know, a lot of Wild West movies especially are filmed at one or two outdoor settings that are, they can completely control and isolate. Even within Hollywood, I know they have studio cities. They have areas where it's just a studio after studio after studio, and they can completely control who comes in and who goes.
Yeah, yeah. But if you are on location, then it's much more difficult to make sure that no one is spying on you. Let's get back to the episode. In the chat room, Inga posted some research. The Sabra in Hebrew is actually a baby name, which means to rest. I'm not sure if that's, you know, again, something they want to, they did deliberately, but perhaps.
Interesting.
There, of course, then there's the solar storm and the fact that the architect knew that the storm was going to, you know, occur and that that storm would knock out the electricity. Now, that was, of course, a reference to Ocean's 11, but I was thinking a storm that you can predict time travel.
We gotta go back to the future, Marty.
So, I couldn't help thinking of Back to the Future. Then we get, the question, how can they force the teller? That gets revealed, of course, by the fact that they use his mate. And then the doctor asks her, I think, Karabraxis, why do you stay? And then she answers, well, my face fits. What kind of answer is that?
Well, he asks he actually asked Mrs. Delphox.
Oh, yeah, true.
Woman. And that was a reference to her being a clone.
A clone, of course. Now I get it. Yeah.
Right. It's to answer the question as you posed it, though, it's an evasive answer to set up the big reveal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Karabraxis lives in a part of the bank, very nice, with all sorts of artifacts from the last Indiana Jones movie, I guess. all the classic stuff that you would find in a museum, like that oozes like, oh, this must have been very rare and expensive, like old paintings. I didn't identify any of them. There is a sarcophagus. You hear Mozart, a part of the... what is it? The Figaro thing playing in the background. So she seems to be very much, you know, at ease there in her little vault. Although
the doctor describes her possessions as the treasures of the universe. And then she later says, I was once the richest person in the universe. So personally, I thought, you know, okay, this is a nice art collection and it's got some interesting looking things like the King Tut sarcophagus and so forth, but I think they had some budgetary limitations on the way that the richest person in the universe would choose to live.
Yeah, well, this definitely looked like let's go through our archives here at the UK studios where we're filming this, and let's just take anything that looks remotely valuable. Just put it in that room.
the BBC is famous for that, where they will take video clips or prop pieces and things like that and reuse them. Like there was one episode way back in the 60s with the first Doctor where they actually showed some of the BBC broadcast of the Beatles as part of the series.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was The Chase. It was another Dalek episode. And the Doctor had this time tuner. And he could tune into any, you know, so he tuned into Abraham Lincoln giving the Gettysburg Address and a couple other things. Well, one of the things he tuned into was the BBC broadcast of the Beatles.
Interesting.
So they're famous about that.
Yeah.
Speaking of reusing things, there's that sequence in this one where Psy is trying to attract the teller's attention by bringing into his own mind all these images of other criminals.
I was hoping we could talk about that one. Because you see a lot of them.
Some of them are from previous Doctor Who related things, like some villains from Torchwood. There's even one from one of the Doctor Who comics in there.
Interesting. I missed that one.
There's a list of the references in that particular very short sequence on the BBC website for this episode. And in the stream of villains, you see a Sensorite, a member of the Slitheen family, the Gunslinger, an Ice Warrior, and a Pteroleptil. And let's see, other aliens seen are the Trickster. He appeared in the Sarah Jane Adventures. Is that a spin-off series or something?
Yeah, it's a spin-off series. It lasted for three or four seasons in after the rebirth of Doctor Who. They brought back Sarah Jane Smith, played by Elizabeth Sladen, who was the most popular companion of the old series. She was one of the third and fourth Doctor's companions.
Right.
And it concerned her, and it lasted until her death a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow.
Yeah, it spun off from the School's Out or School Reunion episode where she appeared as a journalist investigating this school that the Doctor, of course, ended up at.
There's also another reference to the Sarah Jane Adventures because we see an Androvax, which is a body snatcher, and that one featured in Prisoner of the Judoon and the Vault of Secrets. So they, again, just deliberately reused a lot of those clips, of course, for the fans who will freeze frame that and
well, be all in glee. One thing they did in this episode, you know, you're talking about how he brought to mind all these criminals, was kind of trying to do the opposite, this idea of wiping your mind of all thoughts. Mm-hmm. Don't think of anything. And of course, for us as humans, we can't do that.
Yeah. Because
even if we don't think of anything else, we're going to be sitting there thinking about the fact we're not supposed to think about
exactly.
anything.
Exactly. but it seemed to me that they were suggesting that Clara, at least at first, is able to do that. Because then the teller shifts his focus to Sabre, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a bit confused. It was like, is she able to blank her mind or not? Or I don't know.
I think the idea, because it is impossible for us to do that, and that may be part of what they mean and they want us to play off of, is the fact it really is impossible to do that for mm-hmm. humans. But the way I chose to look at that was, it is possible to not be thinking about the teller or not be thinking about mm-hmm. your guilt and not yeah. be thinking about anything in particular and just kind of let your mind wander and mm-hmm. not think about too much.
Just think happy thoughts.
Mm-hmm. This, I thought they played it better here than they did in one of the early episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, where they got thrown to a place in the distant universe where your thoughts would become reality. Oh. And in order to get back home, everybody had to not think of anything bad. And so Captain Picard gets on the horn to a ship with 1,000 people, tells everyone not to think of anything bad or dangerous. And it's like the ship should have exploded the next second.
Yeah, exactly.
But this was Captain Picard giving the order. So, of course, you listen and obey.
On a more comic note, or like the scene in Ghostbusters where they have to think of the next incarnation of the divine, of that being. Marshmallow Man pops in. Same kind of thing.
They seem to suggest here that the Doctor actually can also, in the process of the metamorphosis, when he changes into a new, you know, incarnation, his thoughts can influence his looks. And there's this reference, I find it very intriguing, when he quickly mentions a few of the, you know, his previous incarnations. He talks about a big scarf and a bow tie mm-hmm. and says, a bit embarrassing, that one. And I was going for a new look, kind of like, was it No Nonsense or...
Minimalist.
Yeah, minimalist. And then it turned out magician. That's what he sees himself as.
I think that's a play. I mean, that's a play on the fact that Peter Capaldi was allowed to pick his wardrobe as the Doctor.
Uh-huh.
And it does look like he tried to go minimalist.
Uh-huh.
Because he said he wanted the fans to be able to recreate his costume, you know, for cosplay easily. So it is kind of a minimalist thing, but it has these touches that do make it look kind of like a magician's costume, like the red lining of his dark coat and so forth.
Definitely. That's kind of a meta joke, I think, but I love that line. Plus the one of, who put you in charge? You know, what makes you be the leader? I think it's the eyebrows.
Or that's my special power. What's yours?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. So it turns out the entire operation was a rescue mission for an entire species. And then flesh and blood, that is the last currency. I like that, too. It's ultimately beyond money. Isn't life and riches about flesh and blood, about life, ultimately? And isn't that the most valuable thing in the universe that you want to have or save?
And that hooks into something else, which is kind of a theme in this episode and is a trope in a lot of Doctor Who and other science fiction, which is a kind of anti-business mm-hmm. stance where there's this fear of a plutocracy, that society is really run for the interests of rich people rather mm-hmm. than the interests mm-hmm. of everybody. And that's something that comes up a lot in Doctor Who, and that seemed to come up here as well.
Yeah. Something also very much on the mind of the current Pope, who, when he says, you know, the economy is... People are not there to serve the economy. The economy is there to serve people.
Right.
Kind of put the things in back in the real order, the mm-hmm. logical order of things. And then I love that, you know, goodbye. Clearly the Doctor signaling to Sai, you know, get in touch with me because I've got some more plans in the future. And mm-hmm. then I love this was very subtle. But when Sabra embraces the Doctor and she's, you know, all glad that she can finally embrace someone without that person having to pay the consequences or she having to pay
the consequences. And he hates being
hugged. Yeah, and you see his hand, his arms outstretched and he's like totally paralyzed. That I think, you know what, in a way there is a bit of the Doctor's attitude also in Mr. Pink. who also has that trouble, you know, kind of relating and behaving properly when there's someone who wants his attention. So I wouldn't be surprised if the two of them, when they end up together in the TARDIS, they might have more in common than they currently think.
We also have a kind of developing rivalry between them for Clara's attention.
Yes.
And
clearly.
That's apparently going to come. And even though he's saying, I'm not your boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And he apparently, in that instance, was talking to himself.
Uh-huh.
Because Matt Smith had kind of regarded himself and admitted it, that he was affectionate for Clara in a way he wasn't normally for companions. And so now he's like telling himself in Clara's presence, I, the 12th Doctor, am not your boyfriend. But he's having to convince himself of that. And the last line of the episode about beat that for a date.
Yeah.
Shows he's still struggling with it, which kind of sets us up for the next episode.
Well, and it's this whole theme of him actually being afraid of being left alone. He doesn't mm-hmm. want to be alone. And that goes back to his childhood, you know, being excluded, being different, not fitting in, not having companions. And so if Mr. Pink is taking away his companion, then, yeah, the Doctor is going to be miffed.
Well, that's interesting, too. You know, there is that mindset where he doesn't like to be alone, but yet they're doing this thing where he keeps dropping off Clara and picking her up and dropping her off, and, you know, instead of her, like you said, living in the TARDIS, you know, as companions had done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting.
Have their own bedrooms.
Yeah.
Where did they get the Chinese takeaway?
That's one of the great mysteries that will eventually be explored in Doctor Who spinoff print and audio dramas.
I love the joke, though, at the end. When Clara realizes that she will again eat for her date, and then the Doctor is like, well, you know what? No problem. Calories consumed on the TARDIS have no lasting effect. And she's like, what? Are you kidding? You see her thinking of, you know, heaps of chocolate and pizza. And then the Doctor is, of course, I'm kidding. It's a time machine, not a miracle worker.
That resonated for everybody who's ever tried dieting.
Absolutely. But it was a fantastic game.
Incidentally, it also kind of, I think, resonates off something else they've done previously on Doctor Who, because the TARDIS has a bunch of really weird effects. Like, I mean, not only is it bigger on the inside and the outside, but it also enables people to understand any language that's spoken to them. And they've even extended it beyond that in a few cases. There was a concept that previous doctors talked about the TARDIS being in something called temporal grace, which prevented any weapon used in the TARDIS from functioning.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are other episodes where the Cybermen are just shooting up the place, and they eventually addressed that question, and I believe in the fifth Doctor's time, Peter Davison, and he kind of admitted, well, temporal grace was just kind of a clever lie.
Yeah.
And
if
so
the TARDIS is anything like the Doctor, yeah, it's just lying. Next time, we will discuss the episode The Caretaker.
You okay?
Yeah, of course I'm okay. Why wouldn't I be okay?
I don't know. Every time I see you, it's like you're...
What?
In a rush, in a state.
How's you? Sorry I'm late.
Who are you having dinner with?
I can't keep doing this. I can't do it.
The next few days are all about you. I promise.
I'm the new caretaker, John Smith.
Welcome to Colville, Mr. Smith.
Thanks.
Problem. Solution. Destroy.
Yeah, that's going to be all next week on a new episode of both the Doctor Who series and, of course, the Secrets of Doctor Who. We will see the Doctor as a brown coat. So I'm already, as a Firefly fan, looking forward to it. Jimmy, where can people find you on the web?
They can find me at letswatchdoctorwho.com for my Doctor Who-related website, and they can also find me at jimmyakin.com for my personal website.
Father Corey, anything you want to plug?
Probably the easiest way to find me is Twitter, Facebook, Google+, etc. at Fr Corey Stika.
And what about you, Dom?
Folks can find me at betnet.com, BETTNET.com, and at the Secrets of Star Wars podcast.
Yeah. And if you want to hear our analysis of what happened in the UK, that's tiny, small country, and what exactly was discovered by those drones. And if you're not afraid of minor spoilers, because we don't know really much about the next Star Wars movie, you might want to check out our podcast, which you can find at starwars.sqpn.com. I'm Father Roderick, also on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening, and hopefully you will be back, as will we, for another episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who. More podcasts in the same, you know, vein as this one. If you enjoy this one, you might want to check out the StarQuest Production Network over at sqpn.com. See you next time. Thanks for listening.
When will I see you again?
Soon, I expect. Or later. One of those.
SQPN, leading the way in Catholic new media.